Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, the Filmmakers Collaborative Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Acevedo. In January, the PBS history series, American Experience, kicked off its 36th season with a film written and directed by my guest, Peter Yost. The film is called Nazitown USA and presents the untold story of Nazi sympathizers on U.S. soil. In February 1939, more than 20,000 Americans filled Madison Square Garden for an event billed as a so-called pro-American rally. Images of George Washington hung next to swastikas, and speakers railed against what they claimed was the Jewish-controlled media. There was a call for a return to a racially pure America. The keynote speaker was Fritz Kuhn, head of the German-American Bund. Nazitown USA tells the largely unknown story of the Bund, which had scores of chapters in suburbs and big cities across the country, and represented what many believe was a real threat of fascist subversion in the United States. Here's the film's trailer.
In ever-increasing numbers, the nation's youth has been going away to camp.
In the 1930s, there were these camps all across the country, and they looked normal. But it wasn't normal. It was Nazi camp.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
In the depths of the Depression, a great many Americans started to ask themselves whether the American experiment was failing.
Lots of Americans thought that capitalism, democracy, they were done for, and something else was going to have to take its place.
The membership card and the Friends of the New Germany. Note the American emblem, and over it, the Nazi swastika.
As foreign as this might seem, fascist ideology tapped into some dark realities in America.
I'd like to tell you a few words about our purpose and aims.
He imagined that he was going to build a distinctively American version of Nazism.
Era after power, era after influence, within the very fabric of the United States.
They were literally holding parades in front of Jewish people's homes.
There's no such thing as foreign fascism. Fascism is always homegrown.
The Bund held joint rallies with the KKK and ran dozens of summer camps for children centered around Nazi ideology and imagery. Its melding of patriotic values with virulent anti-Semitism raised thorny issues that we continue to wrestle with today. Peter Yost is a multiple Emmy-nominated filmmaker and founder of the Brooklyn-based Pangloss Films. He's directed and produced numerous critically acclaimed documentaries, including five films for the PBS science series Nova, and more than a dozen for National Geographic's Specials Unit. Making Media Now is sponsored by Filmmakers Collaborative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting media makers from across the creative spectrum. From providing fiscal sponsorship to presenting an array of informative and educational programs, Filmmakers Collaborative supports creatives at every step in their journey. To learn more, visit filmmakerscollab.org. And if you're enjoying this podcast, I ask you to please follow and share. Now on to my conversation with Peter Yost. Hello, Peter Yost. Welcome to Making Media Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I appreciate it.
My pleasure to be speaking with you. So you are the writer and the director of a film called Nazitown USA that premiered on PBS's American Experience last month. They, in fact, kicked off American Experience's 36th season, which is kind of mind-boggling. You and I were just talking about a shared affinity for American Experience. But I want to get into the nuts and bolts of the film, quite obviously. But first off, provide for our listeners, if you would, the historical context for the film, when your story begins and what's happening domestically and internationally at the time.
Well, sure. The film focuses mostly on the 1920s and then even more so on the 1930s in America. And of course, looks a bit at Europe, what was going on over there as well. But what we do is we track the rise and fall, essentially, of a group called the German-American Bund, B-U-N-D, and Bund essentially means organization or group, and there are all kinds of Bunds. In this case, this Bund, or this organization, was an American-based group that had very strong fascist and Nazi affinities. And so what we did is we were intrigued by, again, the rise and fall of this group, but wanted to not just tell that story, but place it in the context of America of the time and look at what forces were at work in the 20s, but even more so in the 1930s, that made America fertile ground for far right ideas, and in this case, even fascist ideas.
Mm-hmm. So as we have a conversation in 2024, and we use words like Nazis and Nazism and fascists and fascism, etc., we have a fixed contemporary audiences have a fixed definition of those terms. In the 20s and the 30s, in fact, thanks to your film, I found out that Mussolini invented the word fascism. How were those words and those labels, how were they received by most Americans? And was there an ism already attached to them in terms of a political ideology?
Right. Well, just to grab on your use of the term ism, I'll use another one right at you. Presentism, okay, which is a term that is often bandied about in a cautionary way by historians today, which cautions people like myself or listeners or students to not bring the lens of today or the knowledge of today to bear when looking at events of the past, or at least if they are to do so, to be aware that they are doing that. And so in this instance, it's very easy to look back and one sees a swastika, and most, to my mind, right-minded listeners would have, you know, in minimum, a visceral reaction and many obviously negative associations with what that symbol means, or even the term Nazism or even fascism at this point. And that is in large part because of our inherited history and what we all know happened, the train wreck essentially, and worse, that was World War II in a global sense. But in the 1920s and 30s, and it's quite interesting, I think, and we explore this a bit in the film, of course, that history hadn't happened yet, at the risk of stating the obvious, and people didn't know that, and they didn't necessarily have those associations with fascism or even any of these other isms that were in the water. And just broadly speaking, it was a very tumultuous time with certain echoes with today's time. Mm-hmm. The 20s, as many listeners know, by the late 20s, you had the Great Depression, but that even came on the heels of a lot of upset in the 1920s, massive immigration restrictions, Jim Crow laws that had been on the books for a while that in many ways separated people rather than brought them together, literally using legal code to do so. So you had kind of a tumultuous, torn apart version of America. Then you had the Great Depression in late 29. And then in the 1930s, there was all kinds of fear, dislocation, and economic insecurity that forced people to really question whether democracy was working in a very fundamental sense and whether democracy was the way forward. And there were significant numbers of Americans, as there were people elsewhere in Europe and other places in the world. But in our film, we explore how there were significant numbers of Americans who were looking for alternatives to democracy, whether that be communism, another ism, or mm-hmm. in this case, fascism. And so many things seemed possible, and it wasn't clear what was going to win out and what was going to work.
What did you see, or what did you learn about sort of pre-existing mindsets towards things like, you mentioned, Jim Crow, so race relations, anti-Semitism, immigration policy? You combine those mindsets, however prevalent or not prevalent they may have been, with the economic upheaval of the Depression. Does that sort of make the U.S. a target-rich environment for these movements that are taking root in Europe to take root in the U.S.?
Absolutely. That was a very real risk. And I would one-up you a bit on that as well and say not only was America a target-rich environment, America in certain ways was a source for a number of the most noxious ideas that were developed back in Europe. Mm-hmm. So the Nazis, for example, had laws that were discriminatory, needless to say, against Jews, against other minorities, blacks, etc. And they borrowed language from state constitutions in America for these Nuremberg laws, the so-called Nuremberg laws, and in some instances rejected some of that language because they found it to be too extreme and heavy-handed. And so the idea, and this is maybe something that we really wanted to achieve in the film that I personally found interesting intellectually as we dug into this process, is that I think it's very easy for all of us as Americans to tell ourselves, and we've inherited a story that World War II happened and we fought the good fight and we pushed back against fascism and we made the world safe for democracy. And all of that is quite true. And I don't want to diminish that. There was great heroism and strength in doing that. And in my personal opinion, I'm glad we did. Yeah. That said, the story can be a little bit too neat because that suggests a good and a bad. And I'm not suggesting moral equivalence here, but it is more complicated than simply we fought back, we made the world safe for democracy. The reality is that is much more complicated, and that a number of the ideas that we were ultimately pushing back against, these right-wing and fascist ideas, had roots in America well before the formation of the Nazi Party in the early to mid-30s in Germany.
And your film points out certain American figures who were iconic American figures, both of the business world and of aviation, in the form of Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, were very strong proponents, particularly Ford, very strong proponents of anti-Semitism, wrote a book or a pamphlet. Didn't even want to take the chance to see if the marketplace would allow that pamphlet to become popularized. He just published it himself and made sure that it was distributed. What did your historical analysis or investigation reveal about how well known Ford's anti-Semitic views were domestically, and how that squared with the rest of the business leader community of the time?
That's a great question. I think there was a great deal of support for those ideas, of Ford's ideas. And I have to say, I knew, as again, many of your listeners likely do, had that sense, yes, and oh, you know, Ford did X, Y, Z. He was maybe kind of a jerk, aggressive guy, but, oh, and he was anti-Semitic, by the way.
Right.
I would probably center the anti-Semitism because, yes. And I came through this looking at that. And in fact, his ideas, he published pamphlets. He essentially, an American, translated and resuscitated in many ways forms of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which are the fictitious, noxious texts that had great influence on Hitler and others, and even to this day among far right.
Right.
He created the Dearborn Independent, which was his own newspaper that basically consistently put out anti-Semitic diatribes. And there's an interesting story. It's not in the film, but I found it striking just personally, and I think it's illustrative. Early on, before Hitler took power which was 1933, the New York Times sent a correspondent to meet this guy out of Bavaria who was maybe an up-and-comer, but pretty marginal and, you know, not yet powerful in the least. And he was in kind of a dumpy office. And the reporter went into this office, and in the waiting room were copies of the Dearborn Independent, Ford's anti-Semitic newspaper. And on the wall in Hitler's own personal office was a portrait of Ford. And so he obviously was an inspiration in terrible ways, arguably, to Hitler and to many, and I think within the business community as well. The final thing, I think anti-Semitism, that was another striking rock that we overturned. Again, many people know this, but the deeper we looked, the deeper it seemed to run and the more prevalent it was at the time. I think it could be easy to overlook, but it was just a cornerstone of American business culture and, in a broader sense, a very common belief in America widely at that point.
So we mentioned Ford, we mentioned Charles Lindbergh, and there was another individual, a priest, a Catholic priest, Father Charles Coughlin. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was sort of, if you will, the Rush Limbaugh of his day on steroids in a way. He became known as the radio priest, mm-hmm. and millions upon millions, I mean, depending when you look at him, but he had more than 10 million listeners, in the tens of millions at various points. And he essentially had a very strongly anti-Semitic and racist position that was listened to regularly all the time at home by everyday Americans. And so he sort of wormed his way, if you will, into the fabric of American culture and was probably, don't quote me on it, but I think probably had the largest audience of anyone in America, I would presume.
And he was unapologetically assertive with his anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. This stuff was not under the surface. And this is, again, I came across this not in the film. This is just me, you know, sharing with you. I came across the other day, the 1939 Princeton University student newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So 1939, remember, World War War is essentially about to begin. Hitler has already taken over Austria, Poland. It's not pretty. Concentration camps are happening. It's clear what's going on, more or less. But America had not yet entered the war, which wouldn't be until 1941 with Pearl Harbor. But still, the world is not loving Hitler from an American perspective, one would think. The 1939 Princeton University freshman poll, they conducted a poll of the incoming freshmen. So these are kids that are going to graduate in 1943. And they said, who is the quote unquote greatest person in the world? And the winner by far was Adolf Hitler.
Amazing.
And second, I don't have the exact number, but something roughly 80 votes or so, 90 votes. Second was Albert Einstein with about a quarter as many votes. Woodrow Wilson was way down at fifth or something like that. Or FDR, I'm sorry, was around fifth or something like that. So the point, and they did the poll again the next year in 1940, and Hitler won again. So, you know, again, presentism, it's very easy to look back and be like, who the heck would ever fall for this? And he must not have had any support. And I don't want to overplay that. And that was a striking, and I'm not sure if there was some sort of contrarian youthful jokiness to that poll or whatever, but still it is what it is and it's Googleable and there it is. And so I think the acceptability of anti-Semitic statements and rhetorics and beliefs should not be underestimated.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You use the word presentism and it's, you know, it's quite apt vis-a-vis the conversation we're having right now, but it almost feels like this presentism kicked in 1941, in the sense that, you know, things went from being kind of gray in the sense that, oh, these fascists and Nazis, they, you know, they are, quote unquote, making the trains run on time. And, you know, we all like this idea of a master race and not, you know, no miscegenation, no mixing of the races. Pearl Harbor was an amazingly clarifying event. And, you know, as a thought experiment, one can wonder if it weren't for Pearl Harbor, would there have been a slow rejection of these ideas, or would it become more fully ingrained in the populace?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating idea. And obviously, it's the stuff of fiction, you know, historical fiction, some of it great, you know, from Philip Roth to Man in the High Castle, you know, these alternate, you know, futures that might have been. And I think to some degree, our film, you know, follows in the wake of that, but it is actually a fairly, you know, archival driven, research driven examination of that question to some degree. We touch on it at the end, not to have a spoiler, but Charles Lindbergh, who you mentioned before, who was an American hero, who most know was the first person to fly across the Atlantic and was kind of, you know, all American looking guy who had a great following, but had strong right wing leanings in many ways, was a big fan of the German government, and it was reciprocated. He received many awards much later than arguably he should have from the Nazi government. There are photos of him Sieg Hailing much later than he arguably should have. Didn't really repudiate any of this stuff and created a group called America First, which resonates with language today, which advocated for keeping America out of the war, but also I think offered a big tent, if you will, for some of these folks on the right wing who had overlapping views. And so there are questions that he had about 800,000 members. It was the largest nonpartisan organization, I believe, at the time or when we entered the war. It was growing rapidly. And then Pearl Harbor happened. And so I think it's very much a live question. What would have happened with such a charismatic, right-leaning isolationist with arguably fascist or Hitlerian sympathies?
Mm-hmm.
It's a question.
And a couple of years prior to 1941, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, you were referencing 1939. Another event that took place in 1939 was a rally in Madison Square Garden, where 20,000 Bund supporters gathered. I think to contemporary years, that's a stunning statistic. As you and I are speaking, there was a lot of, I think, correct uproar over the past few days about a relatively small gathering of a couple of dozen Nazis walking in the streets of Nashville. But 20,000 Bund supporters, again, remind us what the Bund was all about and what was empowering that group so that they were attracting 20,000 visitors.
Right. Well, that was actually, I mean, that sentence you just said, or that concept, was more or less what drove me personally to this film. I was working with an old college friend and a colleague, Marshall Curry, who's made a number of documentaries, great films. And he was working on a short a number of years ago called Night at the Garden, which basically he had come across some of that footage from that event in 1939. It went on to be nominated as an Academy Award short. And I was kind of helping him and just, it was all of 7 or 8 minutes. It's very tight and concise and amazing as a film. And I was seeing that footage with Marshall and kind of, weighing in on this and that. And the whole time I'm like, this is incredible. This is incredible. But if you can get 20,000 of these guys into this arena, what the heck is going on in America more broadly that, allows that to happen? And so your question was really the jumping off point for the entire film, to be frank, because that was just jaw-dropping to see the size and the organizational capacity. And so the Bund, just by way of 101, if very quickly to say who they were run ultimately by a guy named Fritz Kuhn, who was a German immigrant who had been a gunner in World War II, come over as many Germans had done after the war. They were dislocated. It was economic shambles in Germany, and a number of people came to America, among other places, but largely America.
Kuhn ended up, he was a gunner in World War I.
In World War One, yes. Yep. He claimed, yes. And there was a massive, as many people remember from their high school history, massive dislocation after World War One in Europe with the Treaty of Versailles that essentially punished, many historians believe, over-punished, if you will, Germany for having started the war and for militarization that led up to it. And Germany, both because of the war and because of the rebuilding, we didn't make that mistake, arguably, with the Marshall Plan after World War II, by the way. But after World War I, it was in complete and utter shambles in many ways. And people like Kuhn were just desperate to survive and create a new life. And so he ended up coming over to America. Interestingly, ended up working at the Henry Ford Hospital in the Midwest in Detroit. Ford had a lot of holdings outside of his just auto plants, and it was a hospital that allowed no Jewish doctors, at the risk of stating the obvious. And he was an X-ray technician, Kuhn was. Eventually bummed around, did different things, was trained as a chemist, etc. Long story short, there had been an organization in the early to mid-30s known as the Friends of New Germany that literally had connections to the Nazi government and to the German government. And they were agitating and organizing in America for Nazi ideas, essentially. And a number of Americans didn't like this. The press didn't like it. It was starting to gain attention. Hitler and others in his regime basically didn't like this because they thought that they were drawing the attention of the American people and the American government and were going to freak them out and galvanize their opposition to what he was doing in Europe. And so just because he wanted to keep a lower profile as possible at that point and not attract the ire of America, he shut down, he ordered that group, the Friends of New Germany, be shut down in 1935 in America. So it was, Kuhn was an opportunistic and kind of an odd guy. That's a whole other story, but saw an opportunity there because there were the remnants of this organization, this Nazi affiliated organization across America. He saw the opportunity and created a new all-American group, if you will, called the German American Bund. And the term America crammed in there is essential. And he essentially wrapped, both conceptually, but even more amusingly and powerfully, the group in the American flag, in the iconography of America. And so we go into that in the film a bit, but there was a very odd kind of jaw-dropping, disorienting melding of fascist imagery and American imagery that was sort of a watchword for them and became almost their brand, if you will.
And talk to me a bit about these Nazi towns. The film focuses on a handful of them. Was it an accident of geography? Was this about where certain ethnicities had gathered? Why did these Nazi towns take root in some areas rather than others? And just give our listeners a sense of where these places were located.
Sure. Well, so the Bund itself had scores. That's an old-fashioned term that I guess means 20s, doesn't it? It's kind of a cop-out.
That's right. Four score, 20 years ago.
Kind of, you know, it's vague and ambiguous enough. Sure, if you say there's scores of them, how can you be wrong? But it had scores. My guess is slightly under 100, but I'm not sure. So dozens, many dozens of chapters across the country, many of them small. The group itself was headquartered in the Yorkville section of New York City, which is on the Upper East Side. But they were strong as well, especially in the Midwest and places where you had large German immigrant or working class populations, Chicago, places like Toledo, Wisconsin, and then all the way out to the West. I mean, the German immigrant groups were the largest immigrant groups in America, along with the Irish. And so there were Germans all over. And some had been here for many generations, and some had just come over like Kuhn after the war. But there were large populations in many places. And that explains kind of the ubiquity of this group and the widespread nature of it. In terms of the towns themselves, there were camps, which we explore in the film. These are summer camps that were made for children, which many people find kind of striking. And there's some remarkable footage that we highlight in the movie, some of which have been shot by the Bund itself, most of which, in some cases, as recruiting videos, essentially for prospective parents, much as one would might see one for a YMCA camp today or something, if you want to say.
They have a very Hitler Youth feel to them.
Yes, absolutely. And these camps, again, and the exact numbers are not certain, but certainly more than a dozen, probably between a dozen and two, were scattered across the country. They were on the West Coast, in the Midwest, and a bunch on the East Coast, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. And so those were the camps. And on top of those camps, one of the largest was out on Long Island, a place called Yaphank. And they created a group that was called the German-American Settlement League, which was essentially a front group or a money arm of the German-American Bund, created a settlement out there that was all German homes, all white, with exclusive, needless to say, you couldn't sell or welcome Jews or Blacks or anybody who wasn't, you know, Aryan, essentially. And they had, I think, 40 to 50 homes built there, and there's footage and photographs, and we explore that a bit in the film as well. And it's not in the film, but it's an interesting aside, that the bylaws for those racially restrictive, the covenants that made those racially restrictive remained on the books until plus or minus a year or two here, what I'm going to say. I think it was 2017. 2016, a couple went to sell their house in, I think the case was brought in 2015 or 16, and they realized they couldn't, they were very highly restricted on who they were able to sell it to. So they sued and ultimately won, and that was overturned. The point being, it was, you know, until less than a decade ago, those rules were still on the books out in Yaphank, Long Island.
You know, one of the things that struck me while watching your film is these organizations, this American Nazi movement, was so exclusionary, you know, anti-communist, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, anti-Black. So there was a pretty narrow slice of the population that they were willing to embrace. And was their goal just to sort of cordon themselves off from the rest of the population? Or was their goal to use that rather thin slice of the population to build out and to overturn the established order?
Right. I think they had just a fundamentally different understanding, arguably a misunderstanding of what America was than most people might today, or many of the listeners anyway. I think Some of that misunderstanding is still carried forth by certain members of our population these days. But whereas I think many of us think America is a land of immigrants and of melding cultures, and whether it be the melting pot or cultures remain, you know, coming together or remaining separate, it's people from all over the world with all different beliefs, religions, et cetera, et cetera. They saw that as a distortion, an aberration, as something that needed to be essentially purified. And they saw George Washington, with no real evidence, needless to say, but they just claimed it to be so, as the original fascist. And it would be too glib to just say, well, these guys were crazy. How could they believe that? That's ridiculous.
Sure.
because they actually grounded it, as we mentioned before. We had very highly racially restrictive immigration laws privileging white Northern Europeans in a massive immigration act in 1924, for example, where our government said, we'll take relatively rich white people and we won't take other people. Mm-hmm. That is a message to America and to the world. We also had a science, which many people know about, I'm sure, known as eugenics, which mm-hmm. was prevalent in the first decades of the 20th century, that was embraced. And it's easy to look back on this. And this believed that by breeding, essentially, that you could create a better genetic, purer genetic race that had better attributes, and you could get rid of Jews and Blacks and mixed races and all these things that were less healthy and effective, and in the eyes of the German-American Bund, fundamentally less, quote-unquote, American. And those ideas were not marginal ideas. That's, I guess, what I would really love to stress, because it's easy, again, with presentism to say, well, who would believe this? Those were fundamentally ideas that were embraced by the leaders of Harvard Medical School. They were embraced by the American Museum of Natural History. It was, quote-unquote, common knowledge that you wouldn't do this. And we had, as we know before, not to beat the same horse here, but miscegenation laws, Jim Crow laws that mandated the separation in many places of Blacks and whites. So this was not an utterly irrational idea that came from Mars. Like, how could you believe that white people are privileged or better, or that this mm-hmm. should be a white country? When in fact, in many ways, historically, they looked at the facts, they looked at the laws, they looked at the science, and they said, yeah.
There's on the topic of eugenics, there's a great series that ran on, I believe it was HBO, about 8 or 10 years ago, called The Nick. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's the Nick is the Knickerbocker Hospital in New York City around the turn of the century. And the, as you just said, the seriousness and the intellectual vigor that was applied to the study of and the justification of eugenics. You know, it really does, it's shocking.
And to my mind, sorry, just to weigh in, I think,
sure.
Bringing that up, I mean, I think it is all too comfortable many times for people to think, well, it's just an education question.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, you know, I have glasses and live in Brooklyn. And, you know, if other people just had glasses and lived in Brooklyn and read what, you know, went to these schools or read these things or were exposed to X, Y, Z, everything would be okay. And personally, I'm skeptical about that. I mean, education is deeply important, but the sober reality is that in America, certainly these were some of the most educated people. Again, we cited that Princeton poll. These are the elite educated people in hospitals, in places of higher learning, etc. I mean, fin de siècle Vienna before ultimately the tragedy of the first 20th century in Germany and whatever, was the most cultured, refined, sophisticated intellectual place, arguably in the history, you know, since Rome or Greece or whatever. I mean, it's the highest density of remarkably highly educated people. And a generation or two later, it's a complete, you know, horror show. So it's too neat to say that I know this, I'm educated.
Right.
Only X, Y, or Z knew what I know. I think the beliefs are very deep, and it's trickier than one might think.
We mentioned 1941 a little while ago as maybe the starting point of the collective historical understanding of the U.S. in the world during World War II. And when I was watching your movie, I was thinking, man, how did I not know this? So what did you discover around either how pervasive knowledge of this movement was, either at the time and in the immediate aftermath of World War II? And this, maybe you don't have an answer to this question, why it wasn't included in the teaching of what it was like to be in the world during the, or in America rather, during the Depression and the immediate years leading up to World War II.
Right. I think there was just kind of a historical amnesia about this, and maybe it's understandable. Again, we won the war. We came back triumphant. It's very easy, as we all know, even in today's world, to have polarized notions of good and bad. And we were the good guys, and these were the bad guys over there. We push back and then think about post-war prosperity. And also, we moved rather quickly on to communism as the boogeyman.
Right.
In some ways imagined, in some ways real.
Right.
And so we just moved on with history. And I think this was just not something that we wanted to look at or thought that we needed to look at. But as we discuss near the end of the film, it does raise the question, what happened to these ideas? Did they just disappear? And what happened to the people who believed in them? And we explore that a little bit. But I think even as we're seeing in recent years within the political situation in America, and I think, I mean, I count myself among the surprised as well. I'm not putting myself above this in the least, but I think many people were in many quarters kind of shocked to see what came out, whether it be in Charlottesville or has come out in a more capillary way in many, you know, across America in the years before and since then, and that there are some rather extreme ideas that seem to be shockingly widely held. And perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised is one of the lessons of this history, that it was maybe put away. We fought communism. We had these years of prosperity. We had X, Y, and Z happening. We had foreign entanglements. And we maybe never really did a deep dive into some of the underbelly of America and what was still there festering.
Mm-hmm. Your film also does, I think, an excellent job in very subtly drawing parallels between then and now, maybe in terms of the you know, the power of ideas that claim to promise utopias of sorts, right? A purified population is a utopia. An ism that's going to relieve all of your economic woes is a utopia. And you could put communism in that category. You certainly could put Nazism and fascism in that category. But I'm curious, as a filmmaker, when you're making a movie like this in the current environment, how do you kind of thread that needle between presenting, as I said, in a subtle way, parallels to contemporary times without hitting the viewer over their head with it, or without forcing your perspective on the viewer's experience?
Right. I think that's a great question. And it was really tricky. I'm glad to hear that you feel like the balance was hopefully struck. It was kind of kaleidoscopic and, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of shifting. But I think, and Cameo George, who's the executive producer of American Experience, was vital in striking that balance. I think she was just fantastic, because as I'm sure you know, or listeners know, when one dives into a subject deeply, it's hard to keep full balance and perspective. I don't just mean in terms of objectivity, but even in terms of, you know, more because you've been reading or marinating the stuff for months or years. And so it's hard to get a complete and true sense of how that resonates for somebody else. Is it too much? Is it too little? And Cameo, very much to her credit, I think, and hit it right, was encouraging us right from the beginning to let the history speak. And I think that we were in complete alignment. There was no pushback. Mm-hmm. That reminder was really useful for us. And I think in saying that, we didn't have to fish for modern parallels. It wasn't like we had to do some sort of contortionist pose or yogic whatever to find some analogy that makes this relevant. We didn't cherry pick what the Bund was saying. We didn't cherry pick. I mean, the only thing we actually almost didn't use, because it was so on the nose, but I didn't want to do the opposite, which was hide things because it seemed to be too on the nose, which was, there's a clip from the late 1920s. It's very early on, a sync sound film clip of Mussolini in English, who walks up to the camera and he's speaking to a group of Italian Americans, I guess, and he's in Italy and he's making this newsreel essentially for them. And he walks up to the camera and he says, "I would just like to salute or thank all of my friends in America who are working to make America great." You know, and it's like literally the same language that we use, America first, America great, on the same anti-Semitic tropes, the same racist tropes, the same white supremacist tropes. So this wasn't necessarily that we needed to kind of fish for or, you know, drive home an agenda in the least, nor do I particularly make films that do that. I wanted to in a genuine way, whatever one's politics, kind of get at what we were just talking about a few minutes ago, which is hopefully offer people some historical insight into where we are today. And I don't mean, it's not all one-to-one. There are differences, and sure, it was a different time. But this was a film about fascism and non-democratic politics. And what was it about America where that, where those seeds could sprout? And I think there are lessons for today. People will draw them, or they won't, as they wish. But I personally, journalistically, kind of historically, feel like, I hope, not to sound pretentious, but I hope there is an integrity to the way we did it, because I thought over time, really just excavating this history, which, as you mentioned, had been more or less forgotten and the footage less shunted to the side, I think just excavating that has its own power, and it's more powerful than whatever my personal opinion or rant may or may not be in the year 2024. I actually, again, not to sound self-aggrandizing, but hope, and I think American experience is great for this. There's nothing in this film that should date it, sadly. Right. It's intentionally not full of fancy graphics. It's intentionally pretty direct and straight, and we wanted the footage to speak for itself, and hopefully for this to stand as a bit of an artifact that maybe in future years as well will resonate with people.
Absolutely. And there's also a humbling quality in the sense that, you know, we've mentioned several times here, there's presentism. It's easy to feel like, oh, that's what those simple people back then thought. That's how easily they could be manipulated. That's how easily they could justify what they, in their hearts, probably knew to be vile ideas simply because they thought they would benefit from the implementation of those ideas. But, you know, that kind of remains part and parcel with being a human. And it just manifests itself in different guises throughout history.
Absolutely. And we do have somebody near the end of the film that says that a lot of these currents or these ideas are not just, you know, about being American, they are about being human. And there can be an ugly side or potentially that can be tapped for these kinds of ideas. And, you know, the other thing in terms of the humbling reminder, there are so many things I think at this time and in this film that are still, that were unresolved challenges, not to be euphemistic, but I don't like when people say, you know, something that's bad is actually a challenge, you know? It's just like bad.
That's
like
unfortunate.
Like I remember BP had the Gulf spill and they're hemorrhaging the greatest, you know, the largest oil spill ever in the history of humanity. And they have a challenge on their hands.
No, they certainly do. That's why God invented spokespersons.
Exactly. It's a bad thing. But so the challenges, the bad things that were going, but the idea are many of these things that we see in the film and of the time that were difficult or bad even are still with us today. This notion of like othering people, or even more genuinely, the challenge presented by free speech and ugly speech, which we touch on briefly in the film, but is needless to say very much with us today on college campuses and more broadly on social, on, you know, yesterday, not to date this, but the Supreme Court heard the oral arguments for the internet free speech issues on social media platforms. I mean, these are just issues like, can you get up there and spew fascist ideas freely, or should there be limits on college campuses, on Facebook, on, you know, in other words, and these are questions that they were wrestling with when the Bund came up as well around that 1939 rally and many others.
Absolutely. And the recurring irony of the fact that the system that the 20,000 people gathered to support in Madison Square Garden in 1939 would not allow the freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech that was being embodied in that gathering.
Right. Although the Mayor LaGuardia was the mayor of New York City at that time, and he was not a Bund supporter per se at all, but he agreed to allow that rally to take place on freedom of speech grounds, A, and B, because politically he thought it would backfire on them. He thought it would become a lightning rod and make them look stupid and extreme. And in fact, there were many, many thousands of counter protesters outside the garden that night as well. And that is, of course, you know, the argument of many free speech supporters slash even absolutists around the free speech issue, that you got to air these things and then the truth will out and you will have counter speech that will overwhelm it. And that is a way of handling it as well. And in that case, he might well have been right. But just to also add that throughout the film, there are a number of people, whether it be those counter-protesters in 1939, like a heroic journalist that most people have never heard of named Dorothy Thompson, who...
Dorothy Thompson, I was about to ask you about
her. We can talk about it. She's a personal favorite, and people seem to... We've gotten a lot of feedback on Dorothy Thompson from folks who've seen the film and never heard of her. But just... We also wanted to go out of our way to show the counter to this, that the responsibility, if one is going to support free speech, then members of society also do have that responsibility to provide that counter speech and or counter politics. So, yeah, just mentioning that, too.
So, as I said, I would be remiss if we didn't speak a little bit about Dorothy Thompson and the role that she played. So just give our listeners a hint around she was at least one of the canaries in the coal mine, if not the most loud canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, I think the technical term somebody used the other day for me about Dorothy Thompson was badass.
That would work.
Kind of great. And
badass
and
she shouts bunk.
Yeah, I mean, she was great. So in a nutshell, she was an American foreign correspondent who went to Europe.
Yeah.
And in 1931, she interviewed Hitler. So very early on, Hitler didn't come to power till 33, but she had an eye on him from throughout the 30s and called him out for what he was right from the beginning, writing searing critiques, saying this guy's dangerous, this guy's a buffoon, et cetera, et cetera. Needless to say, Hitler did not love her. 1933, Hitler came to power. One of the first things he did was promptly kick Dorothy Thompson out of the country. She has the honor, I guess, of becoming the first foreign correspondent to be expelled by Hitler. We have footage of her actually on the ship home. She wouldn't shut up even as she's being expelled, speaking out about the dangers of fascism. But to her credit, not just in Europe, not just with Hitler, but back home as well in America. And she said, watch this stuff, guys. She came back. She gave literally thousands of speeches, literally thousands of articles. She was tireless throughout the 30s, especially as the war came closer and as Hitler became more and more aggressive. And then in 1939, as we explore in our film, she actually went into Madison Square Garden for this Bund rally with 20,000 Bund members with the express purpose of heckling and disrupting it, which she did, yelling, as you said, bunk, which is kind of a great old fashioned word. I'm using
sure
that word with my kids now. It doesn't work that well.
The ultimate put down.
Exactly. I said that's bunk. And she did it and she was tossed out. There's actually some kind of tangential footage of that. And then she went back into the garden and did it again, and then was thrown out again. So she arguably could be somebody who just saw this early and was incessant in her criticism and warnings.
Most definitely. And loyal listeners to Making Media Now may recall that a two-time guest of the podcast, Jane Healy, is a historical novelist, and in her latest novel, Dorothy Thompson plays a large role. So check it on out. Peter Yost, thank you so much for your time. I want to remind listeners that your film has already premiered on American Experience. However, the film is still available to stream via their website, and it is still available on demand. So pick up your remote control and say Nazi Town, American Experience, and it's going to show up on your television set, and you will be all the richer for having viewed it. Peter Yost, thanks for your time. I've enjoyed our chat.
Thank you, Michael. So have I. I really appreciate it.